what I've learned over time is it's lots of gut. I used to not be comfortable operating with gut. I operated more with my head. I've learned to start to use head and heart and gut to try to understand what would be the cultural intersection. And I think it's also, we have the big tool of social media at our fingertips. And if used in a way that's, you can make yourself more knowledgeable about what's going on there versus getting sucked in the black hole that we all get sucked in. It's like, that's how you can learn what's going on and what catches wind. And what's interesting is like culture will obviously always change and the tide around us is constantly changing. So for a brand to have longevity, it has to have a few foundational staples that never change. And that's the tough part of marketing is figuring, as you know, is figuring out what are those staples and what are the things that can evolve. And that whole Rubik's Cube is what is so amazing.
Welcome to Growth Untold, the podcast where we dive into thoughtful conversations and insightful discussions with world-class people, all with the aim of inspiring, educating, and empowering our listeners.
We are thrilled to have you here with us on this exciting journey to explore the diverse stories and the ideas that have the power to shape the world for the better.
Welcome to Growth Untold, the podcast.
Today, we are joined by a seasoned marketer who has navigated across the world of consumer goods, spirits, wines, and cosmetics. She's made her mark across some of the world's most renowned organizations, including American Express and Avon to Unilever and Pernod Ricard. At Unilever, she honed her skills as a marketer, steering the grooming portfolio to new heights for global brands such as Dove. Following this, she joined Pernod Ricard to lead a portfolio of multiple spirits and wine brands as the VP of Marketing. In her most recent chapter, she took on the role of Chief Executive Officer at King Street Vodka, a brand co-founded by actress Kate Hudson. Welcome to a personal friend of mine, Sona Bajaria.
Hi, guys. Sona. How are you?
Welcome, Sona.
Welcome. So full disclosure, me and Sona have spoken before. She's, I want to say like a family friend at this point because, she's good friends with, my fiance, Emily. So welcome to the show, Sona.
Thank you. Fiance. It's the first time I've heard that. Amazing.
I know, right? Yeah, it's great. I like it better than girlfriend for sure. That's for sure.
I haven't even been able to congratulate you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So, you know, you mentor Emily because we have a gin company called Dharma Gin, and you've spent a lot of years at Pernod Ricard, one of the biggest, you know, if not the most reputable wine and spirits brands in the world. But before we get there, we usually like to kick off the podcast by asking a little bit about you, your upbringing, you know, where you're from, where your family's from. So tell us a little bit about you and you know, how you got here.
No problem. And I hope maybe I'll turn into a therapy session. But
that's great. We love that.
Oh, that's well, what the podcast is all about.
Awesome. Now, first, I want to say I'm super happy to be here. And it's been awesome listening to your podcast so far. I love the way that you guys talk about personal and professional and how they blend together, because I'm a big believer of that. I think work is personal. So there's no way you can understand someone's work, past and history and future, without knowing them personally. So I pretty much got into the world of marketing through a windy path. I am a first generation Indian American. My parents came here from India in the late 60s with pennies in their pocket, you know, similar story to what we've heard. And, you know, what I saw in front of me was the options to be a doctor or be an engineer. I went to University of Michigan, go blue, big win. and I went into the biopsychology route, taking all science classes. Pushed my way through organic chemistry twice and got my first C's in my lifetime, but kept pushing through. And
I loved chemistry, by the way, growing up. I was in AP chemistry, but biochemistry was a whole different world. It was a whole different beast. So I feel you there. I feel you there. I went to U of T for neuroscience for a year and did the sciences growing up. So I feel you.
And or organic chemistry just didn't click for me in my brain, and I started to ask myself, like, why am I doing this? It was senior year. But I did enjoy the psychology classes that I was taking. I was loving understanding how the mind works and how it affects behavior. And then I happened to take a marketing class through Michigan's Business School and absolutely fell in love with that. And I then thought maybe there was a different route for me. I actually thought I was going to go help people and be a clinical psychologist. Took a clinical psychology class and ended up not being able to compartmentalize and say, thought I would fall too deep into people's problems and actually not be able to separate myself. So I started to look for some jobs out there. And American Express gave me a call, and they were actually calling quite a few people, and they were asking them to be salespeople for American Express. So I thought it was one of those calls, but in fact, it was to work on Wall Street in corporate services as a marketing analyst. I jumped at the chance to go to the Big Apple and go to New York City and move there with American Express. Life has a funny way of working out because what American Express gave everyone who got an offer out of college was a trip to Europe for you and a companion. So of course, as a 22-year-old, I was like, let me grab a friend and let me go to Europe and we're going to have a time of our life before we enter the real world. And then my
You're like, we're going
dad,
to Europe
we're
and
going to
I'm
Europe.
quitting after 2 weeks. I'm just taking the job for the trip.
So then my dad said, oh, this is a great time for the four of us to take a family trip. So, you were like, oh, go with my family or go with a friend, but it wasn't really a choice. So me, my dad, my mom, and my sister, we all took a trip to Europe. This was the summer of 2000. And I'm dating myself, but it was the summer of 2000. We go to Europe. We spent 2 weeks there. My dad was a photo fanatic, and so he took tons and tons of pictures. And then I moved off to New York, left Michigan. We were here with 10 of my college girlfriends, had the time of our life. We definitely we worked to live. We didn't live to work. And we went to plays, we went shopping, we went to the clubs. We
Wow.
were having a blast.
And this was, and Sona, this was your first time moving away from home, I'm guessing. Yeah. So this was an insane experience in New York City in like your 20s with your girls. You're working for Amex. Like this must have been absolutely incredible.
It was amazing. It was really a dream come true. And this was before 9/11. New York was very different at the time. And it was so freeing and just amazing to be here in the city. And then in July of 2001, I got the dreaded phone call from my mom saying that my dad was having some stomach pains from his travels, and they went to the doctor, and the doctor found a mass in his pancreas. And the doctor said, I would go live whatever life you want and the memories you want, because the doctor had come to the conclusion that it was pancreatic cancer. So
Wow.
I had at the time I was lucky enough to not have been touched with cancer until that point. This was, 20 t over 20 years ago. And I called my ex-boyfriend at the time, who was a doctor, and I said, my father has pancreatic cancer. And he just said, I'm so sorry. And it was like the worst words you could hear, especially coming from a partner of yours. And I then worked with a mentor of mine at American Express, who I still am very thankful to today, that he said, let's build up your vacation days and let's, why don't you go home and be with your father? And when you're 22, right out of college, you think you are quite important in the corporate world. You don't understand the grand scheme, but he really encouraged me to go and be with my dad. So I flew home in end of July of 2001, spent time next to my father. And unfortunately, the cancer got the best of him. And he passed away on August 29th, 2001. And wow. it was 30 days from diagnosis. And it was really, really difficult to say the least.
Oh my gosh. And then 9/11 happened like a few weeks later.
Yep. And 9/11 happened a few weeks later. And the bridge that collapsed that connected the financial center to the World Trade was the bridge that I walk through every single week to go to American Express headquarters for my allergy shots. And so I vividly know that bridge, and I wasn't there for 9/11, but the phone was ringing off the hook because all of my colleagues were running for their life and were covered with soot. And it was like very, very vivid, but it was all a massive nightmare. And so, you know, God bless the souls of 9/11, but it was a really, really hard time for me because I was affected in a different way.
Yeah. To talk a little bit about how you got through all that, because I mean, this is a lot happening at the same time, and you live in New York, like you yes. live where 9/11 happened 2 or 3 weeks after your dad passes away. How'd you get through this time, especially being, you know, this was your first time moving away from home? So you lived yeah. in New York on your own. You're in your early 20s. How did you get through all this?
So, you know, I always say to people that the pain never goes away. Your mind just stops analyzing it over and over again. And it just becomes less of less that time you think about it, but the pain and the memories never go away. So what I did actually to cope was that I wish I had gone to therapy, but what I did is I clinged to all of the TV shows that were talking about people who had lost their parents at 9/11. So I just clung to the words that people would say. I would just try to live in those words of advice because it was all around you. And it was 24/7. People were talking about this. So you got to immerse yourself in death and immerse yourself in mourning. And so a little bit of a blessing in disguise is that I stayed with my mom for the next like several months, and I decided to find a job in Michigan, and the rest of the country and world was going through a tough economic climate at the time. And I applied to 250 jobs.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Only 250.
250 jobs.
Wow.
And I ended up getting a role at an advertising agency doing research, which was a bit different than the American Express path. And to be honest with you, I didn't know what I was looking for. I was looking for a job. I was looking for a job in marketing. But marketing has many definitions. Marketing is brand management. It's advertising. There are many different routes you can go. I didn't understand. So I took the research job at an advertising agency, learned a lot, but ultimately was realizing that's not where my dream is. But I didn't know where my dream was. And I was able to be there with my mom, which was massive and probably really helpful for both of us. And me and my ex-boyfriend started to drift as you become a different person, probably, you know, some other issues were there. And then I ended up getting a role through my network at Unilever on Dove. Little did I know that this was going to be a nice little door opening to the next chapter of my life. I got this role as a brand assistant. I was a little frustrated that I was a brand assistant for the fourth year. I was supposed to, you know, be a CMO at that point, but I got brand assistant at Dove, working on their hair care launch. And I moved to Chicago. Never thought I'd see myself in Chicago, but it ended up being a very beautiful story because I joined Unilever. I did become a workaholic, 100%. People who know me back then definitely know I was a workaholic because I put, Mina, to your earlier question, I put all of the way that I was dealing with stuff into work because I wanted to keep busy. I wanted to not feel guilty that I had left Michigan. I wanted to just, you know, do something for the world, but really there's no need for a marketing assistant to work till 1 a.m. typically on a regular basis.
Wow.
Yeah. But you also had aspirations and an idea of where you should have been. And, you know, I talk about this a lot, but I think the one thing in my industry that has really messed with my mind is the expectation for myself to be at a certain point in a certain time frame. And when you do that to yourself, it can really mess you up because you start getting down on yourself. You start going, well, I should be here by now. Like, why haven't I gotten there? Why is this taking so long? And so I can imagine, because you just said, and that's why I laughed, you know, you said, oh, I should have been a CMO at this point. You were probably thinking like, what's going on? Like, you know, it's impatience.
Yep, absolutely. Like, I didn't enjoy the journey as much back then. It was more about the destination for sure. And then, but through this, I met beautiful friends. I met so many friends that I am still very, very close to that are like family right now. Because we were there till 1 a.m. together at the office. And Unilever supported me and sponsored me through an MBA. So I got an MBA at Kellogg at Northwestern, super fortunate and thankful for that experience because once again, made wonderful friends that, you know, stood up in my wedding. And
damn. So let me get this straight. You were working till 1 a.m., but you had more workaholic tendencies that you said, let me get my master's
100%.
Alex, do you do this, man? Why aren't you working this hard, brother? What's going on? This is how you get ahead in life, man.
I had to mute myself. Oh my God, you just made me so depressed in the matter
of I've seen your
statement.
LinkedIn profile. It's very impressive, Alex.
It's just a buzzword garden on my LinkedIn profile. No. I'm just trying to impress people. Okay. But hold on. There's so many things we got to talk about here for a second. But first of all, Unilever, what was that like working for it's like a massive for like the people who aren't marketers out there, Sona, right? Like, you know, people like Mina and a lot of people in our audience, like there's probably like two Goliaths in the CPG consumer packaged goods space. Would you agree? It's Unilever and Procter & Gamble. And they're what some people call them, not a branded house, they're a house of brands, because you have so many household name brands, like you said, Dove. What was that like being a part of that huge machine?
It was a gift, honestly, because I got my first assignment on Dove, and Dove is such a beautiful brand because they did a study 20 years ago around women, and they found that only 2% of all women globally claim that they're beautiful, which is a pathetic number. And they took that insight and they said, let's make women feel beautiful inside and out, inside from a self-esteem perspective from when they're very young to outside with our functional attribute of our products, whether it be bar soap, firming lotion, hair care, et cetera. And that was so powerful that what they did is they said, okay, all employees go volunteer with the Girl Scouts, go help them understand why self-esteem at a young age for women is super important. Also, when you capture models in advertisements, you are not allowed to retouch them. You need to love every quote unquote flaw, every bump, every mark, because women are beautiful inside and out. And to learn branding in that perspective from the most pristine way was a gift, because I still have my Dove brand white book, and it tells you what the brand is about. What do you do and what do you not do? And that is where I learned brand marketing. So it was amazing. And what it was like is you were working, they always say like work around people that are smarter than you. It was absolutely that kind of place. Everyone around you was smart in very different ways. I think smart is a very strange word just to throw it out there, but it's about what you do with that intelligence that matters. And I had great mentors that I still keep in touch with. So It was a wonderful place to grow up in. And it was definitely a gift from God, especially after that traumatic losing my father in 2001. So that's stayed.
So yeah. So you did that for 7 years. And you know, what really sticks out to me when I was learning about you is you tend to stay places very long. That doesn't really happen anymore. You know, me and Alex were talking about this with another guest of ours. I think the world is changing so fast now that people just don't stay places long anymore. But you stayed there for 7 years at a very pivotal time in your life. You learned a lot. But of course, you know, what I'm interested most about when it comes to your work is Pernod Ricard. Am I saying it right? First of all, am I saying that right?
You are.
Okay, good.
Really?
So what do you mean really, Alex? Come on, man. What is this? What is this? We're Canadian. We don't French.
I thought you were going to mispronounce it, but you nailed it. You crushed it.
Thank you. So Pernod, you worked at, correct me if I'm wrong, for the longest amount of time. You were there for about 10 years.
Yep.
So, you know, Pernod is interesting because it's mostly wine and spirits. I think wine, they must own some wine
brands. And spirits. Yep.
Right. But what I'm interested about is like when you first got there, you know, how was that experience about learning about the company? Because they own so many different brands, kind of like Unilever, but this is wine and alcohol. It's also luxury in a way. So talk to me about how you got there and what was that experience like? Because you got very high up on the rung there. You know, you weren't a sales brand associate there or whatever you called it. That's for sure. So talk to me about that journey there, those 10 years.
Definitely. So, and one thing I want to address is that when I left Unilever, they were consolidating offices to New Jersey. And I took that opportunity to come back to New York because I felt like mentally and emotionally, I wanted to come back to the big city and do it all over again, do what I didn't get to do when I was 22, but try it again in my 30s. And so, yes, when I found Pernod Ricard, I was at Avon at the time. I was working in cosmetics and innovation, loved learning about how to innovate. We made 1,000 products in less than a year. And, what I have a love for is brand marketing. I love the gray between a functional and emotional side and how you define it, essentially. And I actually was trolling on LinkedIn like we all do, and I saw a job for Kahlua. And I said, hey, I drink Kahlua. Let me go talk to them about this role. They talked to me about Kahlua, and they said, hey, we've got another role for you, Jameson Irish Whiskey. And at the time, I had not had any Jameson Irish Whiskey. I was more a vodka girl, a Kahlua girl. And I took the interview. And at the time, they were marketing to men. I had never marketed to men. And I thought, okay, I'd always marketed to women. Let me try to grow my repertoire of marketing and let me go and try to market to men. Because at the time, that was the strategy. And, you know, to answer your question, it was quite a transition. It was quite a wake-up call on how you transition industries. And I don't know if either of you have worked with Irish people, but that's another gift. Irish people are the best. And I had the opportunity to go to Ireland 18 times in my career with Jameson.
Wow.
And the story of Jameson is just beautiful. But what you have to understand when you go to the spirits industry is it's a three-tier system. You've got the distributor, the retailer, and the consumer. It's very different than when you're doing deodorant or hair care at Unilever. And so you had to quickly learn and adapt and evolve rather than the other way around. No one was going to adapt to you. And I had the opportunity to work with ex-bartenders and ex what we call brand ambassadors. You were working with a whole different caliber of people who understood the on-premise, the bar restaurant environment much better than you ever could because they've actually lived and breathed it. And understanding that bartender and how it operates is so key to this industry that was a big wake-up call. And the other thing that was interesting is how important relationships are. Like, everyone tells you relationships in general, relationships in business is important, but relationships in the alcohol industry is so key. And that was another interesting, you know, I used to run around Unilever with my laptop and my PowerPoint presentation and show everybody how shiny it was. That wasn't going to work in the alcohol industry. You have to get to know people and you have to understand, you have to sit in their shoes and understand what they want and you have to adapt. And that was like a beautiful learning.
For people out there listening, and Sonal, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you know, I've only been in the alcohol industry for a couple of years now with Dharma, but you get, you know, you learn very quickly that it is a very protected industry in a lot of ways. What I mean by that is people love the industry they're in. They love the alcohol business. There's so much to learn. And it's so close to everybody's heart because, you know, for a lot of people, alcohol is a big part of their lives. You know, we celebrate with alcohol. We mourn with alcohol. We, you know, a lot of important events in our life, alcohol is in our lives. And, you know, so I think there's a lot of people in the industry that just they know each other. They keep things in a very tight circle. And so you have to learn all these things and learn this family that is the alcohol business.
Definitely. Definitely. And as you grow and you get more senior, there are more male counterparts as you go up that ladder. So that the other piece is how to find that leadership in yourself, being a female, but also just figuring out your voice. I think everyone has to figure out their voice, but in a different environment, it's quite interesting. And I have a really funny story, and Alex, you'll appreciate this because, you know, how many agency briefings have we done in our lifetime? And I still remember this vividly. I was my first Jameson briefing, and I came in from my Unilever world, and I dressed up in green. I'm not joking you. And I tried to put together a roster of jokes. And my boss was just like, oh my goodness, who did we hire? And you had to quickly learn that it wasn't about operating in this template that you thought was right. It was actually just like jumping out of that and figuring yourself out at the same time you're trying to figure out the spirits industry, is figuring out who you are as a leader and what's important to you. What are your boundaries and what do you care about? Because you're selling something that's about connection. It's about human connection. And so how do you sell human connection? You have to understand who you are as a human.
Yeah. Wow. Just to add to that. So I think that like what Mina and you both were talking about, there's so many unwritten rules about the space working in the alcohol industry, right? Like you've had to learn through immersive therapy and just jumping with both feet in. What are like some other ways you've learned the ins and the outs of the industry other than telling amazing jokes and wearing all green?
Yeah. Spending time where it's made. I think that was another big learning, is that while I worked in deodorant and hair care and cosmetics, the heritage of the products, the factory that they're made in, based in the country that it's produced in, that became paramount in the spirits industry. The story of Jameson, where it's made in Ireland, in Middleton, it started in the back bar in Brooklyn with the bartender as their after shift drink. That's the story to understand in order to figure out how to scale it and how to grow it. And, you know, another story that I wanted to share with you was around the Glenlivet. The Glenlivet was a super amazing career moment because it taught me so much about the industry, but it taught me about teams and people. I was given a promotion to vice president, you know, in my time at Pernod Ricard. At the same time, I was handed the bottle of the Glenlivet, and saying it's flat in sales and we have to fix it. We have to reposition the brand. And it was an intimidating challenge because I, once again, was not a single malt drinker. And how am I going to reposition this brand when I look at it and I don't see the heartbeat? And we built a really great team around us. We had amazing counterparts in London, and we did a lot of digging. We went in a couple different circles, and we ended up intersecting culture, category, and consumer. Culture, Trump was running. It was the Me Too movement at the time. The category was stoked in leather couch perceptions, cigar smoking, older men, typically white men, less women, less multicultural. And we said, we're going to break conventions. We're going to break conventions in how we package this thing. We're going to do bright colors. We're going to break conventions in how we bring this to life. We're going to sponsor New York Fashion Week. We're going to break conventions through where and how we activate and how we explain the product to consumers. They don't need to taste it just neat. They can have it in a cocktail.
And who was your biggest competitor at that time? Would you say it was like Glenfiddich, or who was your biggest competitor then?
So I would say Glenfiddich and Macallan were competitors, but also it was that we were getting confused with Glenfiddich and Macallan. And what's interesting is, like, while they're competitors, there's also emerging spirits in that space that are in the same consumption moments. So those are also the brands we had to look at. But what was amazing is that the route we took to this was not a straight line. It was quite a circle. And what I learned is that surrounding yourself with people that they may be junior to you, but when everyone is inspired and excited about the strategy, they're actually coming up with better ideas than you could by yourself. And they're happy, and they're coming to work with a jump in their step. And the relationships we solidified actually drove to better business results. And that's the first time I really saw in practice how you lead from behind and you get people excited about something. And we started to get this amazing team spirit and culture around us that was getting noticed, and folks were excited about it. And within 2 years, we saw double-digit growth on the Glenlivet. And this was super exciting moment. We took the Glenlivet to the Forbes Women's Summit, and I spoke, amongst Padma Lakshmi and Amy Schumer at an event, and we talked about breaking conventions, and we were really trying to get this brand to be in the conversation with lifestyle. And that was another big learning, is that we all talk about what brands and companies we work at, but actually it's about the cultural intersection. If you don't figure out the insight and the cultural intersection, then really who are you talking to and who's going to care? And that's what jazzes me up from a work perspective, is finding those brands and those opportunities, and that you can figure out, okay, why is someone going to care? Because it taps into something interesting in culture, and it's fast and it's in the moment.
Go ahead, Alex.
Mina, look like you were so calm, man. I'm sorry for cutting you off, man. So I'm just so curious about you. You said it's just the cultural intersection. How do you identify that? How do you identify it from not being artificial, going like, we belong here, when in reality, the facts say this? Do you undergo like massive research to identifying that intersection? Like, what's the process like for that?
Yes. You know what? I think what I've learned over time is it's lots of gut. I used to not be comfortable operating with gut. I operated more with my head. I've learned to start to use head and heart and gut to try to understand what would be the cultural intersection. And I think it's also, we have the big tool of social media at our fingertips. And if used in a way that's, you can make yourself more knowledgeable about what's going on there versus getting sucked in the black hole that we all get sucked in. It's like, that's how you can learn what's going on and what catches wind. And what's interesting is, like, culture will obviously always change, and the tide around us is constantly changing. So for a brand to have longevity, it has to have a few foundational staples that never change. And that's the tough part of marketing, is figuring out what are those staples and what are the things that can evolve? And that whole Rubik's cube is what is so amazing. But if you get it right, it can actually work.
Yeah.
Sona, you were at Pernod long enough that I'm assuming you started seeing the swell of celebrities starting alcohol brands, which, you know, now, of course, with Dharma Gin, is something I'm trying to do as well. Though I'm proud to say, you know, not many celebrities are doing it in the gin space yet. When, if at all, did you see this shift in the alcohol space, this incredibly protected, tight-knit community that we talked about, where, you know, celebrities started jumping in, and it seems like it just hasn't slowed down, especially in the tequila space. You know, there's just no shortage of celebrity brands. What do you think shifted that inspired that movement?
Yeah, so I would say that one of the big advantages of a celebrity spirit or a celebrity brand, without stating the obvious, is that you have a bit of a different media model baked in. You have automatic reach. You have a massive audience to play with. So it sometimes doesn't become a question of how much investment do you have. It becomes a question of how are you going to creatively talk to your audience that comes to you in a loyal fashion for advice, advice, counsel, a friend. They see you as a friend. So how are you going to use that to convey the power of your brand? So I think that trend is what has been increasing. The social media wave has been around for a while, but the way that social is being used has headed in one direction. And so I think that has been the tidal wave that has helped celebrities jump into spirits. I think lots of celebrities are doing it well, and then some have opportunities to improve, as we see. I think one massive compliment to Dharma Gin is that you have to have the quality of your spirit. You have to have a product story. You have to have a reason and a rationale for every ingredient to have gone in there. So that's what I love about Dharma Gin, but that's what I would recommend to all celebrity spirits on top of getting that cultural insight, consumer and category trend nailed and finding that sweet spot. That's one of the reasons I went and joined Kate Hudson on her journey with King Straight Vodka as well. I worked with her last year and had an amazing time working with that team to help build and clarify the King Straight story.
Yeah, so tell us about that, because you, like we said, you were at Pernod for 10 years. You got up to incredible, you know, heights. You were the VP there. You know, you worked directly under the CMO, and you then got the CEO position at King Street Vodka. So talk to us a little bit about that. And is alcohol something you want to continue to do? Do you want to go back to, you know, consumer product goods? What tell us, you know, tell us now at this stage in your professional career where you're at.
Yeah, definitely. So I found King Street Vodka through my network. I think as you grow in your career, I think we're all realizing the importance of your network and keeping up with your network. Sometimes it's the last thing on our list, but authentic relationships with people is really what's important. So I feel like I can always get better at that, but I did meet the King Street Vodka team through my network, and every conversation got better than the last, and the challenge and of the brand and the future ahead became more interesting in each conversation. And then of course I met Kate Hudson, and she blew me away with her entrepreneurial savviness and vision. She had a lot of the dreams that I had in terms of building a brand, as well as, you know, helping women really get a seat at the table, and especially in spirits, when sometimes that there's an opportunity for that as you rise. In terms of my next step, I love brands. So I'm interested in working with lifestyle brands. It can really be in any category, but something that has that functional and emotional benefit, and you need to clarify the gray in between. That I think is where the magic of marketing happens. And it doesn't just take that. It takes people, and it takes teams and people that are really good at what they do. And if you can add that all together in this like magic ball and it all works, then you've got something awesome going.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said earlier about social media and branding, is what you were saying that social media has now become more intimate, especially when it comes to celebrities, in the sense that celebrities are, or people feel that they have a closer access to celebrities, that they know more about their daily lives, that they're like their friends. Is that what you meant when you said there was a shift in social media?
Yeah, I think we have all learned that consumers are becoming more and more savvy every day, and they're able to cut through the BS. But all consumers and people want authentic relationships. They want authenticity. So as they have complete access 24/7 to their social channels, people want that realness, but they also want to feel in the inner circle. They want to feel the intimacy. And so, you know, celebrities are probably under tons of scrutiny by consumers because you can always find something wrong. You can always like point out a flaw. But at the end of the day, if like 80-20 is authentic and real and you feel close to the person, you feel like you know them, that's when probably it's most in tune with giving a message about your brand. And if you can actually be just real and honest, that's probably the best bet, because that's what consumers want from all brands, right? They want consistency and they want honesty. And so it's no different with the celebrity brand. It's just that you all of a sudden have this living, breathing personality that can add major kudos to your brand.
And being a woman all these years in branding, a woman of color, have you seen that change over the years? Like you said, you know, the truth is the truth. And of course, the alcohol industry, for example, is dominated by men. I do think that more room is being made for women and people of color. But how has that affected who you are today? What are some of the challenges you had to overcome? And what's some of the advice you recommend to young entrepreneurs of color that feel like, you know, they're facing similar challenges?
You know, I have a kind of a different perspective on this, which is I think that there's probably, assuming that the conditions are decently set in a particular, you know, scenario, I think that it has a lot to do with inner confidence and your inner voice and what you're kind of this circle you're doing to yourself. I think that, again, assuming the conditions around you are set up to a certain extent, I think that the power is within you to figure out the formula that can work for yourself. And, you know, I think through my 22 years of work experience, of course I've had many, many downs and, you know, a good amount of ups, but in those down moments, can you really pinpoint it and say, oh, there was, you know, it's because of this, or it's because of that condition, or is there something you could have done better? So I try to have that attitude. Otherwise I think I might drive myself crazy of what can I control? What can I do to change the situation? Because it's very difficult sometimes. It's very easy to sometimes point to certain things and it's very easy to get down, but how can you actually help yourself? And then more importantly, how can you help the people around you? I often joke with like members, like when I've managed teams, is like, grab a seat at the table, because you often see junior people walk in a room and go to the super corner of the room and grab a seat and try to hide. And it's like, nope, grab a seat at the table. If you're in the room, grab a seat. And that's what I try to tell myself, because sometimes I forget, grab a seat at the table, go sit up at the front. It's okay.
Yeah, man, Alex, that's incredible that you say that, Sona, because Alex, isn't this something that we've heard over and over again from, you know, we're lucky that we've just sat down with so many successful people, and everybody kind of says the same thing, that you have to grow the courage to grab a seat at the table, that you have to have the confidence to be wrong. You know, I think what happens for a lot of people, and it's certainly what happened to me, is when I was younger, we get our confidence eaten away by all these little things, whether it's people bullying us, whether it's teachers telling us we're not good enough, whether it's, you know, parents maybe not guiding us and encouraging us enough. Whatever it is, when we're younger, we get all these little signs and these kind of little, you know, inflictions onto our confidence that when we grow up, we start taking those things and we start making those wounds deeper. And I think it's that really holds you back because, you know, when you look at any successful person, they're always confident in themselves and they're not afraid to make mistakes. They're not afraid of rejection either. You know, you take a look at the industry I'm in, acting, and, you know, every successful actor out there, maybe they were afraid of rejection, but they found a way to overcome it because at the end of the day, the industry is filled with rejection and you have to find a way to move on. So I love what you just said there because, you know, I think the way my brain translated that was whether you're working at a law firm or, you know, a big company or you're an actor, whatever it is, I think the lesson is be confident in who you are. Try to figure out who you are. Be confident in that. And don't be afraid of rejection. Because like you said, that example that you gave about the juniors going and sitting in the back, I think a part of the reason they're not going and taking a seat is because they're going, I'm not good enough to be seen. I'm not good enough to be heard. I'm going to be made fun of. I'm going to be ridiculed. And maybe if they just had more confidence to sit at the table, then people would look at them and people would hear them and they'd be surprised that they have a lot to offer. So I love what you just said there.
Yeah. And I remember this takes me back, Mina and Sona, to your point. I was one of those people, and that I started my career in the agency, and I started an agency, and they used to actually, you know, to get the nerves out of the junior staff and junior coordinators, we would actually have to present something cool in the marketing realm. It was called like knowledge share meeting. So we'd have to present something cool we saw in sponsorship marketing to like all 30, 40 members of the team. And I was one of those people who I was like, oh, hell no. Like I wanted to go to the back. I want to crawl underneath the table and go underneath the shoe. I was terrified of that. And like, how did you like, I guess, get this confidence? It just seems like you have this confidence in your craft. It seems like you have, you know, Sona specifically, this confidence, this belief in your ability to get it done, double digit growth, you just said earlier. Did you develop that through repetitions? Did you develop that maybe through building the relationships? Is there maybe something or maybe a multitude of things that contributed to that?
I think I struggle with it every day. I think that when I was given that VP role on Glenlivet, I had 26 people on my team. And sometimes when you have your own imposter syndrome, and then you're trying to develop 26 people who are looking at you, how can you go in a room and sit in the back if you're telling the 26 people not to? So you have to somehow jump into that courageous mode when you're scared because people are watching you. I remember this one instance in which somebody I didn't feel treated me well in a conversation at work, and it was in front of someone on my team. And I knew that I had to handle it in a way because she was watching. So I had to muster up the courage to go and ask for a few minutes and confront the issue and talk with this person when in fact, I would have rather crawled into the corner and not addressed it, not confronted it. But that helped me because the conversation was great. We got to a good place and I absolutely needed to say something. And so I think having teams and people watching you has also helped because people see you, whether you like it or not, as you grow in your career, people are going to start to see you as an example and they're going to watch you and they're going to emulate the behavior. So if you don't do it for yourself, you got to do it for them. So I think that's been a part of it. And then the other piece is that bringing it back to my dad, when he passed away in 2001, we you know, just had to go email through email, at the time, letter through letter, of everyone wishing their condolences. And the red thread that came through all the notes was, your dad had the highest integrity. So he had, just a little bit about him is, when he moved here, you know, again, started with pennies in his pocket, built his, he worked at a lot of the big car companies in Detroit, but then he eventually went out and started his own business as a quality consultant. And it was a very successful consulting business, and it was like a one-man show. And when we got those notes, they were from business colleagues saying, your dad operated with the utmost integrity, never taking advantage of a situation. He is a friend I will miss. He taught me a ton. So when you have these like beautiful letters and you cling to those words, at the end of the day, what matters on your gravestone is that, how did you operate? How did you leave a person? Does XYZ really matter? Or is it really how the person felt at the end of the day? And I think it's the latter, through the experience that I lived. And so I take all of those, like, really, you could call it cheesy, but I take all these like life lessons, and I just bundle them all up and be like, okay, if this is your last day, you know, and I don't want to live with regrets, how am I going to act today? And it's a lot of pressure, but it's also like, I think, real. It's like, that's the story that I was given, just like we were all given different stories, and we all have our trials and tribulations. I'm not the only one here.
Yeah. It sounds like, sorry. It sounds like, honestly, and it was just consistent with something that I wanted to bring up, which is, it was coming across a LinkedIn newsletter where you were featured in it. And it's similar to the sentiment that you're sharing here about living each day like it's your last. And it seems like that profound memory, or that moment that happened to you in your life with your father passing, was probably one of the greatest teachings you've learned about life and you know, and yeah, treasuring each moment, right? And it seems like it's honestly being a major contributor to your success and the outlook of your life every day. Would you say that's correct?
Absolutely. And why I mentioned that Europe trip is because those are the last pictures I have. And imagine, at the time I was like, oh, I got to go to Europe with my family, not my friends, and have this like wild trip. But I actually got an entire photo album out of that, and I wouldn't trade that for a second. So it's just interesting how life works out. Like, you sometimes don't see the madness through the method to the madness, but then you may see it like 20 years later, you know, and like, that's how I feel like life is.
Yeah. When I look back at my life now, more and more, I recognize that my most powerful moments come from my darkest times. And it's incredible that life happens that way. And I tend to think a lot of it like, you know, like plants. You know, if there's a storm one night and these plants get a ton of water, and they tend to grow the most when there's sunshine on the other side.
Yeah.
And I think that's just, you know, it's true. It's hard to see it in the moment. You know, it's hard to tell people like, hey, while this really shitty thing is happening to you, try to figure out a way to take advantage of that.
Yep.
It's not done consciously, but, you know, I think unconsciously, just having that hope when something bad is happening to you of like, this is really crappy, I'm going to get through this, and I'm going to, you know, sit in it, but knowing that, you know, better days are ahead. Yeah. And for you, Sona, now being a mother, you still live in New York, by the way, which, I mean, you must freaking love New York, because there were so many opportunities for you to leave New York, and you always found a way back. But being a mother in New York now, how do you balance that with your incredibly busy lifestyle?
Yeah, my son, he's I got married later in life. I found my partner on the later side, but he was definitely well worth waiting for. And then I had my son 3 years ago, and he was also well worth waiting for. You know, I don't know. I mean, I know you're not a parent yet. Alex, are you a parent yet? Okay. So definitely enjoy your life pre-parent, but but there's a different type of life post-parent. But, you know, life is hard and different and busy, but like he's the best thing that ever happened to us. His name is Dylan and he's amazing. But in terms of balancing, it's interesting because when I had him, you know, my life, I feel like has two major chapters. One was my father and the second was, Dylan was in the NICU for a few weeks. He's okay now, but it was a bit scary for the first few weeks of his life. And when you have a moment like that, you know, you think about how do you want to spend your time and how do you want to spend, you know, like every hour you have. And I did a lot of soul searching, a lot of digging, and I talked to a lot of people, especially moms. And I got a lot of good advice. The advice I got was don't feel guilty. It takes a village. And I feel like I really try to live by that, which is whatever moment I'm in, whether it's a work moment or it's a moment with Dylan or it's a moment out with friends or family, it's like, be in that moment. Don't feel bad. Like otherwise you'll miss out on that moment. And so stop feeling bad. Just be 100% in that moment. And the other piece of advice is it takes a village is like, don't be shy to either ask for help or surround yourself with the help that, you know, is in your means. And I try to do that, which is building community and, you know, getting kind of setting up your circumstance to enjoy the time that you're with him and with your husband. But Dylan is the biggest joy. And, you know, it reminds me of business school a little bit because like going back to my workaholic days, when I was at Unilever and at Kellogg, two different things pulling at your time, you have to sort of like come to that idea that being perfect, you don't have to be perfect all the time in your studies and your work. Like you can, it's not, you don't want to be an average student, but you could get the job done. It's just how effectively you work and where you put your attention. And I think this is the same, which is I'm going to always be 100% for Dylan. Something else will fall slightly, but it doesn't need to fall to average.
Well, Sona, I mean, you've left us with two great things as we, you know, end the podcast. And again, things that we've heard before, you know, living in the present moment, I think that's so, so important and something that I try to improve on every day because I'm the type of person that really overplans and overthinks about the future and my next 10 steps and what am I going to do and why am I not the CMO yet of my own company and what's going on. I tend to overthink these things, but you're right. Living in the moment and being present is really, really a gift. If you can get there. And the other thing is, you know, about community. And we've talked to other people that say, yeah, like grow your board of advisors, grow the people around you, because you're right. It's hard to do it alone. And sometimes, again, we think it's hard to ask for help. But, you know, having mentors, which I'm so lucky that Emily has you, you know, and having mentors in your life that you can speak to, that you can call upon is really important. And it's something that I've realized now as I'm in my 30s that I just haven't nourished enough in my life. I wish I had more mentors, or I wish I had, you know, put in that effort to develop those relationships a little bit more, but it really is so important. Definitely. Alex, you have anything as we finish off here?
No, Mina, you wrapped it up well. But the thing I took away, Sona, from you, just from observing and, you know, and just this whole conversation, it's just like you have such an innate curiosity for everything, like just life. And like you seem like such a person who's like dedicated to always pushing the envelope every day too. And it obviously is a big reasons why you were so successful and why you're, you know, the former, you know, CEO of King Street Vodka. Like it just seems like you bring your A game. You like, just like you did for this podcast, you're like, let's show up 10 minutes before, let's do this. You were the first guest to just be so proactive at that. So I just feel like if you're like that, you do that every, you know, other aspects in your life that exceptionally well.
Oh, thank you guys. And you can feel free to cut this part, but I just wanted to say kudos to both of you because, you know, I did my own sort of getting ready for this, watching a couple podcasts, like looking at both your profiles, but I'm so I'm so impressed by both of you because you guys have this like amazing, long standing friendship and like school experiences that are so interesting. And while people can probably relate, it's like, what did you guys do with that? And I think making this podcast about, I don't know, call it the unsung heroes, maybe like the not celebrity people that maybe have a story to tell is quite interesting. And, you know, it's funny because I was like, Alex, I was looking at your, you know, history, your work history. And me and I was looking at like the Aladdin trailer and just like, it was like, I was like cheering from the side of like, you guys go, like, go get this. And I hope that the podcast is already successful, but I hope it continues to have all the success in the world. And, you know, you guys are getting really like interesting personalities on there, which I think is cool. I've already learned a lot from watching the few that I did about like the board of directors and all of those things are so good. So keep on going.
Thank you so much. And yeah, thank you for saying that. We've been, you know, it's tough. It's tough growing anything, right? It's tough building anything, especially in the beginning. You don't have any resources. You're doing it all yourselves. And it's tough, but we think it's important. And, you know, we'll keep going. And you as well. We're wishing you the best on your path forward, whatever that may be. And I think it'll be the greatest and biggest and most rewarding thing yet for you. So whatever that role is, I hope it's Dharma Jin, but whatever that role is, yeah, good luck. You're going to be amazing. You'll kill it.
Awesome. Guys, amazing. Thank you so much. This was fun.
Thanks, Sona.
Thanks for tuning in and listening. Please subscribe, share, and join the journey of Growth Untold. Don't miss a single nugget. Hit that follow button now on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and Instagram.